This is, I believe this is recording. I hope this is recording.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. We are at 808 Ledgemoor Boulevard in Grand Ledge. This is July 17th, 2008. And the interviewee here is Manuel David Birch, Jr. And the folks that are going to be asking a couple questions today are John Asaf and Craig Gleason. Chief, if I may ask, and I call you Chief because, of course, the Chief of Police in Grand Ledge, since we're in that jurisdiction right now and we're drinking out of Grand Ledge coffee cups, what first drew you to become a member of the Lansing Police Department?
Well, I'll tell you, I come out of the Navy, and I went back to Oldsmobile, which is where I'd worked just before I went in the Navy, and I thought that that's what I probably would be doing, is a lot of young people work their whole lives there. But I worked there for a little while, and I looked all around, and I seen all these old guys that couldn't even hardly hear anymore, and to talk to anybody, right next to you, you had to almost scream all the noise and machines and going. I thought, I'm not going to do this my whole life. I want a people job of some sort. And so I got thinking about it, and one day we were downtown, and there was a Lansing policeman standing on the corner. He was helping people across the street, and he looked pretty sharp, and I thought, there's something there that caught my attention right off the bat, and I thought, well, that's a people job, and it's mostly outdoors. And it's the kind of thing, I kind of like the Navy, too, so there was a little military flavor there, too. And so I put in my application. And lo and behold, I ended up May 1, 1951, and they swore me in. Started that day.
Very good.
In a borrowed uniform.
Oh. Do you recall any of the your first days, any particular event or events, maybe the first day or first week or whatever, any particular thing that comes to mind when you first hired on? Or maybe you went right into training. Maybe that would be more appropriate. What kind of training did you get?
Well, back then there was no training that day, the day you started. You worked with another officer, and that was your training. Well, my training was really... really intense. I went out with Oscar Face on Beat 8, which is in South Lansing. And we worked that night, and he showed me how to shake the doors and check the windows and do this and that. And, of course, the depot was open 24 hours a day, and trains were running all night long. There was always something on that beat. There was a lot of people, a lot going on. And so I thought, well, that's okay. So the next night Sergeant says, fall in. And so we're all standing there and calling off the names and making the assignments to all the foot beats, which there was 12 of them back then, 12 walking beats, and plus the cars. And so finally it came, I kept listening for my name. Pretty soon it come up, Birch, here, sir. And I says, B8. And then he went right on to the next name, B9. And next, B10. Well, listening for Oscar's name to be, Oscar Face, my trainer. So it was over with. I said to the sergeant before he walked out, who's my partner? And he looked at his sheet and he says, you don't have a partner. You had one last night. Well, yes, sir. So the car would take you out to your beat, and then you'd get out. You'd pull the hook, And that was the extent of my instant training. Here I was out there, and, I just done the same thing as I did the night before. And talked with people, and this is a pretty good job. A lot of walking and everything, but It's a pretty good job. Back then you walked that beat, and twice a night you had to go all the way to Mount Hope. Mm-hmm. For the rest of the time you stayed down in the area between mostly the Island Street, right, which was right across from the old Diamond and Grill that was in mm-hmm. operation at that time. And then it went the north up to Washington Apartments, which is right there by the river. And that was old Beat 8. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got my feet wet. Back then they hired one and two people at a time. When you get about a dozen guys, which might take several weeks or maybe even a few months. It was a few months before we went to any kind of a school, and the school was one of the captains. I remember Captain Warner done a lot of the training, and mostly consisted of traffic laws and how to fill out an accident report and do all these kinds of things. And it was there wasn't any formal training like it is now. There was no certification back then. It was just you got your feet wet by working with other officers. But then they put you in this school. And as a matter of fact, the first real school that I went to was LCC in the very first class. I graduated from the very first class, which was became later on, what do they call it today? The Mid-Michigan Police Academy. But our instructor, we had others come, but most of the instruction came from Charlie Pegg, East Lansing, legendary police chief out there. And we all graduated. I don't believe anybody quit or fell off or anything like that. And that was the very first class, formal class, of what they called an academy.
Do you recall maybe how long that class went on as far as how many weeks?
Oh, it went on for months.
Okay.
It went on for a long time. You went part-time, of course.
Oh, okay, not like today where they go every day.
No, we didn't go all day. We this was all over a period of time, and you went on your off hours.
Oh. Okay.
And it wasn't as intense like it is now.
Okay.
And there was never any driving instruction.
Right.
A lot of firearms, but that was done not in the school. Captain Rainwater was the head of the pistol shooting range, which was on Willow,
right
there by the city limits.
Yeah.
And of course now it's in a nice place out way out there on.
Right.
The Donnelly Center.
When you first explained your second night of duty, walking Beat 8 by yourself, had you had any firearms training prior to that going out? And for that matter, I'm assuming that you were issued a firearm.
I had a firearm, and the only firearm training that I had on my own out there was the U.S. Navy.
Okay, so the police department at that point in time didn't train you in regards to that, but they issued you a weapon.
I had a .38 revolver with a 5-inch barrel.
Okay. Interesting. Very interesting indeed.
And you wore them butt forward back then.
Yep, cross draws.
Cross draw.
Yeah.
That's the way it was. And it had a flap over the top.
Yep.
It wasn't exposed, it was flap over the top.
The best kind.
Yeah.
I always liked that.
Yep.
And the uniforms, of course, everybody, even the sergeants, wore the, what do you call it?
I'm going to say breeches?
Breeches.
Really?
Wore the breeches back then.
Oh.
With puttees.
Puttees,
which was
okay.
That's what they called puttees. And most of us bought our high-top shoes, black shoes, from Sears, the only place we could find them, that didn't have the hooks on them. They were laced up to the top of it, and then your puttee went over the bottom of the puttee went over the top of the shoe, and then fastened up, and it came up to just under the knee.
What was the purpose of that? You remember why they had to have the puttees?
Well, I think it was just a part of the military structure of police departments back then, and of course, and that's in the army, and especially the cavalry. You know, that's the way they dressed.
Right.
We were a little different than other police departments. A lot of police departments didn't do it that way. They had the long pants, and as a matter of fact, we used to get a lot of compliments from out-of-towners about our dress, our uniform, because it was different.
Okay.
But now it came from, originally probably, was the, the state police wore that kind of a uniform when they were a kind of a cavalry in the beginning.
Right.
And then they went into the cars and everything, and then I don't know when they disbanded the breeches, but we had them until, I don't remember the year that we went into long pants and this, you know, no more breeches, but I know we liked it because the breeches, they were kind of hot in the summertime.
Oh, yeah.
They were pretty hot. And the uniforms were wool, of course.
Right.
And our in the summer, it was kind of, I always thought it was kind of funny. In the summertime, we wore real dark blue, matching the pants, dark blue, almost black, shirt with, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. I was going to say in the beginning before I counted them, I think it was 16 silver buttons. They had a clip on the back, and they were detachables, and this shirt had to be dry cleaned. But fortunately, dry cleaners done that for us quite cheap. We had to pay for it ourselves, but they done it quite cheap. Because if you washed them, first of all, they'd shrink them, and second of all, they'd start fading after a while because they didn't have the cloth that they do now. So, but that's what you wore. And then in the winter time, you didn't wear the black shirt with the light blue tie with matched the stripe on the side. You wore a light gray shirt with the same tie, but you wore your coat over the top. Now, a coat, then, called a blouse, which they still wear, I think, when they have a dress up, like for, I think they wear that for the funeral people?
Ceremonial types.
No, the chief has one,
and
but not the,
their
they
honor
took
guard.
Them away from the patrolman years
did they?
Ago.
But honor guard, I think, has it.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's what we all wore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Everybody wore it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even the sergeant, even the sergeant. The first people that wore a different uniform was lieutenant. Mm. Everybody else, the sergeants and all the patrolmen, regardless of where you were assigned, you wore the same identical uniform.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Of course, you wore your Sam Brown with the cross strap over the top and then all the paraphernalia on there. But now, they've got so much stuff on them now, I don't know how they walk.
Do you recall any, like, we'll call it a major event, such as a labor strike, snowstorm, flood, major homicides that you were involved in that come to mind that you'd like to share some comments about?
Oh, gosh. As far as a big strike, when they, I can't think of the name, but they built all those great big apartments out in South Lansing there.
Longs.
They had a big labor involvement there in which there was a lot of damage done by they called them, they said a lot of them was shipped in from Detroit or whatever. I don't know, you know, how true all of that was. But there was a lot of damage done because there was, it was union against non-union, and it really got to be bad. And at different sites, and we worked round the clock, extra people, all kinds of extra people, and I remember that one went on for days, and there was a man hurt, I remember, by a truck trying to pull in, and there was some argument as to whose fault that was, and never was completely settled, I don't think, but that was a big problem. And then they had another one time at Motor Wheel on North Larch, and that got to be a bad situation. Matter of fact, Bill Cavanaugh, I think, was a captain, and they used tear gas. It was got that bad down there. But that's the biggest things outside of the riots of 66 and 68, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they were really bad. There was fire all night long. There was gunshot. You never knew where it was coming from. Couldn't pin it down, and had a lot of manpower. I remember I was assigned one night to with Cloyce Griffin and in detectives, and there was some cars that was going around, driving around in like a parade-like situation, and they wanted to know where these cars are going because they had a white flag up on top of the aerial. They wanted to know what these cars were doing and why, and they were filled with people, black people, and they told us to follow that caravan and find out what they're doing and where what's going on. So we did follow them when we was going down Butler and what's the next street over from Logan? Butler and
no, Butler's and Logan are parallel.
Yeah,
but Kalamazoo maybe.
It's before we got there. It's Butler and North South Street. We got
I see what you're. Yeah,
we got right down into that area, and. Cars went right on real slow going through, just a sea of people, just hundreds and hundreds of people. And nothing happened to these cars. I mean, we were at the tail end of it, and all of a sudden when we got there and the people closed in like that, and bricks and stones and bottles, everything started in. It just peppered our car. Windshield went out, all kinds of things happened. A brick came through the back that had been smashed before that, but then it flew through there, and right back on my shoulder, it tore a great big rip in the car seat. Griffin was driving, and he floorboarded it. We had to have brushed or struck some people getting through that thing. We went straight ahead real fast. We got several blocks away, and he slowed over and pulled into the curb, and we were both sitting there just almost shaking. And he says, "You all right?" And I said, "Yep." "You?" "Yep." And we wasn't hurt. And so we reported then on the radio what had happened. They said return to the station immediately. So downstairs we went, you know, down the ramp there. They come downstairs, the brass, and looked at the car. It was almost destroyed. Just full of dents and actual rips in the metal from bricks and things of that sort. That was scary.
Yeah.
That was scary.
Let me ask you a question. When you started, the police station was the old building.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Tell us something about the old building, what it was like, and then what it was like in the process of changing from that building to the new building.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the old building was kind of, well, it was stone, and it was kind of Gothic shaped, if you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, actually, it was from the outside, it was kind of a landmark type of important looking building. And it was it two stories or three stories? I forget now what it was. But it was City Hall and police at that time. And the locker room was down in the basement. And part of that basement went right up underneath Capitol Avenue. Mm. And there was rats down there that big.
Did they have their own lockers?
Yeah. Rats? We all had lockers. And mine was in that row that was right up underneath. We didn't know it, of course. They had a ceiling of some sort there. And I say we didn't know. We knew where we were, but it didn't show it, like there wasn't any dirt or anything like that in the cellar. But that's where our locker room was, and out where you would fall in to go to work with an old pool table. And the floor wasn't even at all. And this pool table had its own eccentric dips or something in it, so that if you'd play there long enough, you knew what the ball was going to do. Well, that was quite of a challenge. That was always very interesting. Wooden floors down there. And then you went up the stairs, and then that's where the south part of the building was police, and the other part of it, I'm trying to remember now. Anyway, some city offices were in there too, but the police department took a good share of that first floor. And they, of course, they had what they called the police desk. That's where the officer in charge was, whether it be a sergeant or whatever. But back then, each shift was a captain. And there was one lieutenant and one sergeant. And then one of them usually was off of that three. And that was kind of the way it was back then. There was a building, a stone building, garage really, that was to the east of the main building. And it was backed in there an old Cadillac, hearse-looking ambulance, and when there was an accident and a PDPI, what they call the driver, who was at the desk, he was always at the desk working with the sergeant or whoever was in charge, he would have to run and get in that ambulance, and then he would start toward the where the accident or someone shot or hurt or whatever was. And it was your job when you heard the siren. Well, I think they turned the lights, the amber light on in your call box too. But you should, your job was to get to the curb in a hurry. So if all patrolmen would come out to the curb, the first one he came to, he would pick him up, and that was, you'd ride along. So they made the second man to help pick up the person on the gurney and put him inside.
What a system.
And that's the way that was handled.
Wow.
But the chief's office, the captain of detectives, all those people are all right there on that one floor. And it was squeezed in. Now, the jail was there too.
That's what I was going to ask about.
And that was indeed a dungeon. I mean, it was deep, the bowels underneath, way down. It was, well, in modern times, today, the health department and everybody else would be screaming about that, and there would be. But it was accepted back then that, well, that's all they had. And we didn't have very many people in there. They still had to take anybody that's going to be held for very long and still had to go to the sheriff's department. But we had overnight drunks in there. And back then, if you were arrested for drunk and disorderly, the next morning, if you're sober enough, they'd get you over there to the judge, and they would arraign them, and it would, I think it was cost them $10, $10 fine. And of course, we had our town drunks, the same people, over and over, all the time. My first arrest I ever made was on B-Day in South Lansing. And it was a drunk bike right close to Aces Bar. You know where that is?
No, you don't mean Aces. Probably
Nassif Bar.
Right.
Was there. And there was a call box on the corner of Island Street there. And I see him down by the railroad tracks, and he fell down a couple of times. So I went down there and I arrested him, and took him, marched him back up to the only thing you could do. We didn't have radios then, and marched him up to the call box and propped him up there and pulled a hook and told the dispatcher that I had an arrest. And all the while that he was standing there, he was waiting for the car. He kept repeating over and over, "Thank you." Not "thank you," "thank you." And he'd wait and pretty soon, "thank you. Thank you." He kept saying that. I never forgot that. That was the first arrest I ever made.
Interesting.
Yeah.
While serving, did you receive any particular on-duty type injuries due to, I don't know, car crash or fight-type situations or anything along that order?
Oh, fights, a lot, several times involved in that kind of thing. Some serious and some not so serious. The worst I was ever hurt is when I crashed on a motorcycle in 56. Tore this left leg up pretty good. And I've had trouble with that leg on and off ever since. Blood clots, twice. But That's the most serious injury I ever had when I was on duty.
And so you rode motorcycle. Do you remember about what years you rode the bike then? And what maybe other experiences you had with the police motorcycle?
Let me see. I went on a motorcycle in 1953 or 54. I'm not sure which.
Okay.
And the training for the motorcycle then was Sergeant Kimball took two of us out to Potter Park. And no, the first time I went out there, it was just Sergeant and me. I followed in my car, and he rode the motorcycle out to Potter Park. And so he showed me all about the motorcycle and the whole business, and told me, you know, what he could. So I got on it and stalled it a few times, of course. They had a clutch on them then and monkeyed around with it, finally got it going. And so I just rode in, you know, around areas real slow like that. And couldn't put it in an upper gear, just a real slow gear. And after I got the feel of it a little bit, then he'd stop me and then give me something else to do, and then a lot of stop, start, stop, start, stop, start, just over and over and over and over. And then there was a parking lot out there where he began to tighten the circle up too, so that you begin to know how to ride real slow and turn circles and everything like that. And after a few sessions of that, he said, "Okay, take a ride." So,
off you went?
Off I went.
Good for you.
I rode 8 years.
Eight?
Motorcycle.
Okay.
Yep. And after that, I went in the accident car. After that, it was a follow-up accident investigator, which nowadays they call it action or accident reconstruction.
Yeah.
And back then, it wasn't as sophisticated as it now. They've got really experts at that now.
Yes.
We were so-called experts at for the time. But a lot of on-the-job type training back then.
Can you tell us, how about any other memorable arrests that you've made in your time there? Anybody important or kind of important?
Well, I arrested a lot of people that thought that they were important.
Well. Yeah.
I don't remember, you mean like a politician? Or
I
don't ever remember arresting anybody that, maybe small time important, but not what anybody would recognize. I did have the pleasure, though, while I was on a motorcycle, and this is, I think, is interesting. John F. Kennedy came to town, and he was running for president. And I was on a motorcycle, and I'd been on motorcycle long enough so that I was one of the senior riders. And my assignment was to keep my left handlebar, about a foot away from the side of this convertible. And he was sitting up on top of the trunk and going about a walk speed. All the way down Michigan Avenue, we ended up at, what's that big building at Michigan State? There's a circle drive up to it.
Union Building?
Union Building.
Yep.
Union Building. That's where he was going to make a speech or something. So we were going down Michigan Avenue, and we got to about right around where Bud Kautz is now. We'd passed most of the people. There were still a lot of people along the side, but the big crowds, we'd already passed that. And we was chatting. Of course, he's sitting right this close. You and I, and so he asked me things like, did I have a family, and do you have any kids? And I was, of course, I wanted to ask him questions, but he was pretty common fellow to talk to. He seemed more interested in Lansing and me and my family than anything. So finally, I said, ask him if he would give me his autograph. And he said, well, sure. Well, he didn't have any paper, and I didn't have any paper that I could think of then, except my ticket book. On the back of the ticket book is just plain vanilla-colored little thin cardboard. So on the back of the ticket book, he wrote his name, and he started to hand it back, and I said, well, I have two boys, sir, and my daughter wasn't born then. And he said, so he wrote it again. And then he laughed. He says, I'm giving you a ticket now. And he gave me the back of the ticket book and everything. We laughed about that. And he was a really nice fellow. I really liked him as a person, you know. He wasn't president then. But signature is now in the hands of my oldest son, who is a lawyer. And he has a beautiful, big frame thing, and he's got parts of the newspaper in there when he was there, in the pictures, the whole business, and he has the back of that ticket book in there,
beautiful.
Under glass.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
John Birch has that in his office.
Great.
Yeah.
That's super.
Yeah, I remember I was going home from work, and I got right about Cedar and Holmes, right in that area. We already knew the president was shot, but everybody was waiting to see, you know, if he was alive or whatever. And communication back then wasn't as good as it is now. Now it's almost instantaneous. But anyway, the final announcement came that the president is dead. I pulled over and cried.
Sad day.
Yeah.
Definitely. Savvy. Remember any other particular kinds of assignments that come to mind that you cherish, you had a lot of fun at, or for that matter, having fun? I'm sure that you may have been involved in some pranks of this sort or another, if you wish to share some of the pranks. Pranks are usually fun to talk about.
You mean mischief?
Okay, whichever.
Oh, yeah, we had our own mischief. You know, the guys of my age group, Charlie and Billy Cochran and, well, Kavanaugh until he died, we still laugh. They always poke fun at me about it. Of course, the rule was the same as it is probably when you guys were around. No ganging up. You know, don't gang it up at the coffee places. Well, we were on a motorcycle at the time, and it was a football game, Michigan State. And so after our assignment, you know, we're free to patrol and everything, and then go back to our assignment when the game was over. If you wasn't assigned to go out there later on, that's where we went, a lot of us. Anyway, we got the traffic all over with, and the game was going on, so we're out running around. Well, of course, the old sign when you meet another motorcycle, especially, was this, the signal was probably the same when you guys means
coffee cup.
You want a cup?
Just like that, yeah.
Guy would nod like that, of course, he'd peel away, and we'd go somewhere. Well, on the corner of Foster and Michigan Avenue, there was a New Hut, it was called. It was a restaurant. So we went in there, and of course there was a couple of guys already in there. So there was three or four of us in there. And it was unusual because we're all working. Nobody had a day off. Oh, boy, all of a sudden, here's Lieutenant Atcherhoff and Sergeant King. Chewed our ass out and told us to get back to work. And so we left. You know, we knew we was wrong. Nobody argued about that. Well, maybe an hour later, I was at another place, and there's some guys there. So here again, there's probably three or four of us, and we're talking. The guys in cars as well would join us last time. And all of a sudden says, oh, shit.
Oh. Don't worry about it.
It's okay.
Here was Lieutenant Atcherhoff and Sergeant King again. Oh, man. So the same thing happened. They got after us, you know. So we left again. Now, here's the part that the guys really razzed me about. It wasn't too long after that, after our traffic assignments and all over with and everything, I went to the White Spot to have some lunch and some coffee. And in this case, I was the first one there. So, well, really, it wasn't my fault, I didn't think. Anyway, first thing you know, another officer comes in, and a motorcycle officer comes in, and we've got another gang up. And all of a sudden, oh, no. Here's Lieutenant Atcherhoff and Sergeant King. Only this time they're mad, especially Atcherhoff. And they really let us have it, particularly me, because they said, three times? Yes, sir. Whew, boy, I thought, oh, man, I'm in some serious trouble. But it died away. Died away. But I was razzed about it for years, and still to this day, some of the guys remember that.
Well, one of the folks that we interviewed had a little story that apparently due to your stature, or maybe in some instances the way it was expressed, the lack of it, they made a little box for you to stand on. Do you recall anything like that?
That's true. That's in the old building. Yeah.
You talk about that one?
Oh, yeah. That was Bob Crouch was the guy's name. And as a matter of fact, I broke him in. And the funny part of it is I broke him in, but I was hardly broke in myself at the time. Anyway, he was short. And I still maintain to this day that he was inch shorter than me. But anyway, I think it was Russ Dietering made this box, and they painted it bright green. And I believe they put Shardy on it, penciled it on or painted it on or something. Anyway, they put that thing down, and they put it down by Crouch first, because he was on the end and I was next. And so they told him to stand up when he said fall in. And so made Crouch mad. He was really touchy about his being short. Made him mad. He kicked it clear across the room. And so everybody just laughed like hell. And so they said, well, Birch, you get on that box or something of that. So I don't remember the exact words. But anyway, I went over and retrieved the stool and brought it back in the lineup, and I stood right up on it at attention. And then, of course, they really roared. And that story went, I'm sure it's probably embellished in many, many quarters, but that's true. That happened. We used to have some fun. As I remember, the sergeant was one of the loudest laughers.
No doubt about that. In regards to maybe your family, how did family, meaning parents, siblings, what have you, how did they react to you becoming a police officer?
My parents were extremely proud. You thought I was the mayor of the city of Lansing, you know. They were very proud, and my brothers and sisters, and all of our relatives. I remember my parents even came over one night in the summertime on the near Shawassee and in Washington, and that's where a call box was, and they sit there in the evening. A lot of people used to, there was angled parking back then, a lot of people on a Saturday night or something would park there and just watch people. You know, that was a evening thing to do. And they come and park and actually watched me walk a beat. of course, my kids were little, and they were proud, and my wife was, and of course, and everybody I knew thought it was kind of neat, and I liked that.
Well, sometimes, like it's usually the mother, feel it's such a dangerous job that sometimes they don't relish the idea. They're proud in one sense, but they're afraid in another. And sometimes we hear stories.
My mother
like
was
that.
My mother was very afraid. At first, my wife was, but she learned to tolerate it. As a matter of fact, I was quite proud of her. She was a perfect policeman's wife. In that she never complained about all the shifts I was on and the holidays where I had to work, all those things. Then something would happen in the city that that would get her out of my alley out the night he was shot. She was really upset over that. And did you remember Alley Out?
Yes.
Was you there when Alley Out was there? He was a captain when he
I
retired.
I don't think so.
Well, Alley Elk and I were partners, actually. Back then they had what they call a driver, who was the guy that was in the regular district, and then you had what they call an extra. Mm-hmm. So when that driver, who was assigned and made rotation and everything with a shift, when you were an extra, you would work... You became the driver when he was off. Well, the night that I was off, Al Yelk was working with another extra, and that's when he was shot, right there on South Pennsylvania at Lumber Company.
I want to say Gilbert.
Gilbert Lumber.
Yeah.
How much did they pay you when you first started?
$3,200 a year, and you bought all your own equipment. The only thing they gave you They gave you a breast badge and a hat badge. They were kind of tin-like. They weren't very fancy and nice like they are now. They weren't very heavy. And then you bought, well, let me see, what else did they give you? Oh, they gave you a revolver, 18 bullets, call box key, big brass key,
mm-hmm.
Handcuffs. Well, that's about it, I think.
How did they pay you in a paycheck, or did they actually give you cash?
Paycheck. Yeah, paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
Every 2 weeks, you got a paycheck. And you, all your clothes you bought, this company, Wolfram's or something of that, something like that. I can't remember it for sure. That's the supplier. They would come in and measure you and everything, and then they'd order. Of course, they kept your sizes and everything on record then. But you you bought all of your own clothes, your own shoes, your own puttees, everything. And it would come out of your paycheck, $10 a payday, which $10 was, that was like making a payment of a whole lot more than that every month.
Mm-hmm.
But we were happy. We were happy and we're proud. And I think I hope they still are right today. I hope the officers feel the same as what we used to.
Well, there's some difference in my observation. There's some difference, but we don't need to go there with that regard. But
yeah.
Anyway, that's just with as you're talking about here, the uniforms and all, and you were there. You probably saw many transitions of different uniforms and maybe even other kinds of equipment. You want to think about that and share anything that might come to mind as far as maybe even weapons or maybe whatever comes to mind.
I think the single biggest thing, and we thought it was like Buck Rogers or something, when they come out with the radios.
Oh, okay.
But they were large. They must have been this high, and they were wide like this, and they were very heavy. As a matter of fact, they had a strap, an extra strap to go over in case you didn't get tired of carrying it. And of course, they were squawky and not always reliable, dead spots and things of that sort. But we thought that was really something, because before that, you were out there all alone. You were all by yourself. Some of those beats were pretty big, like Beat 11. I think it was Beat 11. Was from Pennsylvania Avenue all the way to Mifflin on Michigan Avenue. Now that's a long stretch.
Yeah,
that's a long stretch. And there was no call box in between. There was a call box in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and the next one was clear out here at Mifflin. And that was a lot of up steps, a lot of buildings in the back and the alleys. You had to go up some steps to get to the door. So you couldn't go right to the next door. You had to go down the steps and over here and then up the steps again. So you worked pretty hard when you were walking the beat on the night shift when you were shaking all those doors. But I thought it was the greatest job there was.
Then the radios came along, and so that had an impact where you felt, did you feel maybe, I don't know, safer having that communication piece with you, or?
Well, by the time they come on with those kind of radios, I was on a motorcycle.
Okay.
And a motorcycle had a radio. It wasn't too reliable, but you had to turn it on. Well, it was already on. You could receive. But to talk, you had to reach back here, and there was a toggle switch. And they had the radios in boxes that are about this wide, probably about this long, about this high. And they were on what would be in normal place, normal motorcycle saddlebag here. Okay. They were hooked on back here. They're black, and that's where all the radio equipment was in there. You reached back with a toggle switch and flipped it up when you wanted to talk.
I never knew that one.
And we thought that was kind of neat, mm-hmm. and but I never. I wasn't on the beat anymore where they carried the great big ones.
Okay.
So I didn't have to contend with that. But although that was, they didn't have a walkie-talkie though. Yeah, I was on motorcycle. I'd been maybe getting ready to come off motorcycle before they got the walkie-talkies.
All right.
I don't even know what year that would have been. Let me see. 51. I'd say close to 1960. They what they have when you guys come on?
What they had when I was on was they had the little walkie-talkie, but it slipped into a charger-like device and was effectively your car radio too. And when you made a call, you only had, if there were two officers, only one ended up with the radio, you'd push a button and it would pop out, and you could take that along to the, for instance, inside to a domestic call.
Oh,
but
okay.
You had to bring it back out, plug it back into your car. And that became your car radio again.
Yeah, I remember those. I remember those radios. I may have been in the accident car by that time when they got those.
When I came on, which is April of 66, I walked the beat without a radio. I had to use the call box. But it was soon after that that they came out with a portable radio type.
This was 66?
66.
That's a long time
ago. I know. It seems to me they had them, but only like the lieutenant of the shift or the captain of the shift, because when I came on, they did have captains in charge of each shift. And they had, like you expressed earlier, a captain, a lieutenant, and maybe one or two sergeants. Yeah. That was 66 in the very beginning. A lot of things changed very soon after I came on. But, yeah, there was only a very, very few, if maybe one or two of these radios that they had. That's what I recall. And that was April of 66.
I remember what we often call the explosion of technology. Being about that time in the late 60s when all these gimmicks came out. Mm-hmm. But before that, it was kind of the same for a long time. Didn't seem to be a lot of advancement then, but when it started, it exploded. I mean, there were just all kinds of things began to happen then. And every time, every year, there was something better. And the city was good to us on this. They supplied us with up-to-date technology. And way before some other small departments even thought about that kind of stuff, we had all kinds of stuff.
Well, I don't recall, maybe John, you recall, or maybe you do, Chief, the Omnibus Crime Bill passed, and I want to say about 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And that flooded a lot of federal funds to law enforcement in general, which then, of course, private entities got involved in, you know, research and whatever, and so that it kind of flooded the market and provided us funds to try these different things out.
Best of everything.
Yeah, and that's where grants came in, too, and that's why we got into helicopter crime prevention, the traffic, what was that? We had a
like STAR program.
STAR, that was one of them.
STAR.
But then there was like a the traffic thing where we had a we stopped them in the lane check for traffic.
Oh yes.
What was that called? I can't think. Anyway, it was traffic related because I know I rode bike in 72 and 73 and I was a chase vehicle because if they tried to go through this like, you know, roadblock thing.
Roadblocks, yeah, they
and
were.
And we'd have to chase them down. Yeah. But anyway, that was another grant. And
that,
maybe
was
that was
a drunk driver related.
I think it
thing.
Was on safety.
It
I
was on safety to the vehicle.
Vehicle.
Because
check.
We would actually tow vehicles that didn't measure up to standards.
Yep.
You know, maybe the brakes were bad. That was a huge thing. Brakes and lights and things of that nature.
I remember one of the things on motorcycle, they came up with an idea. I really liked it because before that we tried to be good to people when they, you know, the taillights was out or something wrong with their car. We'd say, well, please get it fixed. You know, we'd stop them. And then we got so we hated to do that because they got mad at you and everything. And nobody wanted to write that kind of a ticket. They, well, I won't use the whole word, but chicken something.
Mm-hmm.
So they come out with a thing, and the courts went along with this, where you could write a ticket for your headlight out or something of that sort, but you didn't have to pay a fine if you got it fixed right away.
Yes.
And you took it down to the central garage on Shawassee there, which that's where the police vehicles were fixed at that time,
right,
taken care of. And they would check that you had your headlight or whatever it is wrong, and then they'd write on it and take it to court, and you didn't have to pay. So now, then they started to enforce that a little bit better, which I think made it a whole lot safer. Made it a whole lot safer.
Yeah, equipment started to get fixed a little better then. Exactly.
But you'd be surprised in making that kind of a stop what other stuff you run into. No driver's license, no insurance, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that, of course, now you're getting into something pretty serious.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Let me change the subject a little bit. You were a captain. Captains went to staff meeting, at least as far as I can remember. Did you go to staff meetings?
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us anything interesting about any staff meetings you might have been involved in?
Oh, we had our laughs and things of that sort about something that unusual had happened. Usually, I can't think of anything really outstanding. We just exchanged information. The purpose for that whole thing was each division knew what the other was doing, and we were able to exchange information. And there was a bond there too between each division head to cooperate and everything, but I can't think of anything. I can remember when the chief would be upset with us for certain things happening. You gotta tighten up, you gotta do this or whatever, you know, something gonna happen on the street or something. And
now, there was a chief, I believe, and I got it confused, I'm trying to remember. There was a chief, and this is through stories, that had some kind of a system where they'd, like, fine you a quarter, and then another chief came along and got rid of that system. Do you remember anything about that?
That was O'Toole.
O'Toole?
That was O'Toole that had that. Yes. A fine for all kinds of different stuff, some of it real laughable.
Okay.
But sometimes it was almost a little bit on the serious side, too. But it was, if you were late.
Okay, that's a good example, yeah.
If you said the wrong thing, well, you know, or maybe a swear word.
Okay.
It was kind of fun stuff.
So it was Chief O'Toole that basically brought that about and then declare that, okay, Captain Birch, that's going to cost you 2 bits, pay up or something like that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And then it was, they got rid of it when, I don't know who got rid of it, after O'Toole was, who? Gleason was after O'Toole. And Gleason, he's all business type.
No business, okay.
Dick don't laugh a lot. and he's a really great guy if you get to know him.
Oh,
he's a real great guy.
Yes.
But we didn't call him Grump for nothing.
Yeah, I know.
We called him Grumpy when we were all young patrolmen. I walked beat with Dick. You know, his beats would be next like that, and we'd meet and say, how things going? Okay. Yeah. I'd say, well, it's a nice night, and okay, you know, and he was always cold. Yeah, he has a cold up and everything. He said, so goddamn cold. And
yeah,
but he was a heck of a nice guy when you got to know him. But that's what we, everybody had a nickname. Not everybody, but most of the nickname, and they called him Grump.
Well, as you know, I'm not related to him, but we spell our last names the same way.
Yes, I'm aware of
and,
that.
But when I kind of...
Yeah, and
I,
we got him laughing, and, John.
And when I went out of the department, all of a sudden I became Little Grump, and I didn't even know why.
Oh,
but
yeah,
then,
that's
of course,
why.
Someone finally
that's
told
right.
me why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was, that was pretty good.
A long, long time ago, when I was brand new on the police department, there was some kind of an event. You were in the involved with the Boy Scouts, and I went to that event, I think, on duty with you and maybe a number of other officers. I can't remember that, and it occurred at Lansing Catholic Central. Do you remember that? It was sort of like a jamboree or something.
Oh, yes.
I was always curious about that because I can hardly remember anything about it. Can you tell us anything about that event and why I was there, for instance?
Well, that was the annual Okemos Camporee,
yeah.
Chief Okemos Camporee. I was the, matter of fact, I was, what do you call it, Camporee Chief. I was a Camporee Chief 6 different years. And all those years was, not all of those years, but my troop won the Grand Chief's Award. They had the Grand Chief's Award. That was the whole business. They had all kinds of things for scouts. You probably remembered. You went from place to place doing different skills and
yep.
and all that kind of stuff. And that was a big part of my life. It was Boy Scouts, and I think the proudest day in my head was a shock. Also, was when I was awarded the Silver Beaver Award.
Excellent.
And that's scouting's highest for civilians. And I was also selected the Scoutmaster for the National Jamboree. And that was neat. Went on to.
What year was that?
That was 69.
Okay.
I think it was 69. And Farragut State Park, Lake Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. 50,000 boys from all over the world. Plus, that was just the boys. Plus all the hundreds of men. And essentially what we had was a dream troop. They were all handpicked from all of the scout troops in the whole Tri-County area, the Chief Okemos Council. And so I had, I was a scoutmaster and I had 2 assistants and I got to pick them. And for the scoutmaster they interviewed, that went on for several weeks, and I was lucky to be picked. And then 37 boys, which made it even 40. So we boarded the train in Lansing right there on Grand Trunk, Washington Avenue, and went to Chicago. And our stuff has already been shipped by truck ahead of us. And we hiked from the one station to the Great Northern Station in Chicago, and went right across the top of the United States to all the way to Seattle. And got off and took a bus from there to the Farragut State Park. It was quite a trip. Quite a trip.
That it was. You left the Lansing Police Department, retired from the Lansing Police Department, and became a chief of police in Grand Ledge.
Mm-hmm.
Did you leave the department to take that job, or were you ready to retire and it just happened to be there?
Well, I was thinking about retirement because I had the time in 27 and a half years, I think. I had the time in, so I knew that I could leave. But what I was thinking about, to tell you the truth, is someplace where pay into Social Security, because that would give me a little bit more financially in the future. And I learned about the chief over here had a heart attack, and it wasn't coming back, and they had an interim person running the department. So I'd heard about it through another person, and then this person must have told a councilman here in town by the name of Bob Fine. And I got a phone call, and he called and wanted to know if he could come and talk to me. I said, well, sure. So he showed up at the house, and gosh, he had the city charter and financial, a whole bunch of information about the city and the department, and he wanted me to put in my application. And I said, well, okay. So I did. Well, and I found out there was about 30 other guys that put in their applications, so I come back and told my wife, I said, don't hold your breath. So I went about my business, and it was maybe a week or two after that, they called me and asked me if I'd do an interview. So I did, and then they called a few days later and wanted to know if I'd do another interview, and that was just two of us then. So I knew I had a shot at it then. The very next morning, the manager called, city manager, and asked me when I could start. I said, well, I have to let my chief know some advance. I have to let at least 2 weeks. And so I went down and talked to Gleason, told him. Here I ended up over here. And I had a lot of fun over here. Completely redone the department.
Probably needed it.
That's what I was going to ask. What did you bring to the Grand Ledge Police Department that you might have picked up at Lansing that Grand Ledge didn't have prior to that?
Well, Captain Young and I almost completely rewrote the rules and regulations. That's one of the things I brought with me. I brought with me another little pet thing, and that was the evaluation system. They had none here, and I also brought there was no records here either. I asked for this is not to belittle the department previous to that, but I asked for the personnel jackets of all the men so I could get to know them a little bit better, because it was only I think 12 men at that time. And there was none. And the dispatcher, who was an old man, he was not a sworn officer, he brought me his, and it was a single piece of paper, and all it was an application. I said, well, there's no personnel records then. So that's what I rebuilt. And I've done it very simply. Everything I've done was very naturally very similar to LPD.
Well, a good base.
I had a perfect base, and I had a perfect experience of all the different divisions, so that I had a pretty good idea of what this size of a city ought to be doing.
You had a son on the police department, Bill. Did that ever cause any issues, problems, or whatever for either yourself or him because of the father-son issue there?
None at all.
Okay.
None at all. I was always proud of Bill when he was a cadet. Matter of fact, I told him, he came to me, I don't know if this is something you're interested in or not, but he came to me, he was living with two or three other guys in an apartment. And he was working at some job, and he came to me one day and said that he was interested in the police. And he knew there was a cadet program, because I was kind of running the cadet program at the time from P&T. And I said, well, that's a good idea. It's a good career. And so I asked him, why, and he, he said, well, he thought it was a good thing, and he admired what I was doing and all, everything that he wanted to be a policeman. So I said, okay. The condition is, don't you ever embarrass me, and you know you have to go to school full time, and your grades better be up there, because I don't want you to embarrass me. Yeah, he told the mark, and he'd done a good job, and I was proud of him. I was proud of him.
Very good.
And I think he was well regarded of his peers. From what I heard and everything.
From my standpoint, I believe that, yes.
Oh, yes.
Of course, being a father,
yeah. But sometimes being a father, you don't always hear all the other stories.
That's right. That's right.
I've got some older boys now. I'm just learning some.
Yeah, Luke Moronic. Him and Bill are really good friends. Luke Moronic said that... told me one time that Bill was well respected amongst his peers over there. But he liked to he could have, I guess, had a shot at promotions, but he loved that dog.
Oh yeah.
He did not. He loved that dog, and so he decided that. Professional patrolman, there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you're right, it isn't. It's the actual backbone of the whole department.
Mm-hmm.
But those patrolmen out there that can make you look pretty bad, or they can make you look pretty darn good.
Well, you mentioned that you were sort of in charge of the cadets. Were there any other programs that you were in charge of or helped to create at LPD?
Oh, a lot of the systems, the rules and regulations and the systems of doing things, and of course the remake of the department was happening then too, and they changed it, the names of various things and done things a little bit different as time went on, and I was part of that. Sometimes an important part, sometimes just a tiny part, but it was always interesting to see the changes happening, and always hoping that it's for the best.
How about the union? You were there well before the union was created, and then through the creation of the union, and then into it's pretty established. Can you chronicle some of that, of your thinking as that occurred, because you were up there in rank probably before it actually got going.
I could see where it was really needed. I mean, police and fire and school teachers and people like that were notoriously bad paid for doing a really good job and an important job. And so I could see that this would be a pretty darn good thing. And some things needed to be done. I was not against the FOP at all. Matter of fact, I hoped that it would move forward. And we didn't do anything right away, the upper ranks. But that even fit in later on. And I didn't join reluctantly. I was glad for it, because it was very helpful. It brought police back in line where they should be in terms of financially, and then certain protections too, health-wise and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
So it made a true profession out of it, right along with school teachers was doing about the same thing that we were doing, those kind of things too, because they used to serve at the pleasure of superintendent, just like we did. We used to serve at this whoever they could just fire us.
Yep.
Yeah.
In the area of, well, it's not really 100% political, but in the political arena, perhaps you dealt more with politics when you came to Grand Ledge, but do you recall any so-called political issues with Lansing, and then maybe if you wish to go into Grand Ledge, so be it, as far as how that impacted police work at the higher administration?
Oh, I know that a time that was not any pleasure at all was budget time at LPD. O'Toole was pretty, well, actually he'd done some good things. We didn't like it very well. Well, first of all, and I don't know whether he'd done this on his own or whether the mayor had something to do with it, which was Jerry Graves. And you probably heard the term zero-based budget.
Yes. Yeah.
So what they'd done is they said, you're going to start out like there's nothing. You don't even have a budget. And you have to justify all these line items that you want. Mm-hmm. Well, I took that as kind of a challenge. I know a lot of people didn't agree with me, but I took that as a kind of a challenge because I think that's the right thing to do is if you want something, you should clearly be able to give them why you want it and what you're going to do as a result. And so that was a good time, I think. I learned a lot. I learned an awful lot about that part of the operation. And I think that that really helped me when I came over here. As a matter of fact, when I came over here, I got with some of the other department heads and got them to doing that kind of a system, and the fire chief said it was the best thing that ever happened. You know, the other time they just, in handwriting, wrote on some stuff that they wanted and handed it in. And nobody talked to them much about it. You either got it or you didn't get it, and that was it. It made it more formal, made it more business-like, I guess is a better word. Made it more business-like, and to run your department or division like a business.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to go to city council meetings as a captain?
Oh, a few times, yeah. Yeah, I didn't like that. I didn't mind the public speaking part of it. I just didn't like going there.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't like it too well. Grand Ledge, I had to go to all of them down here. Yeah.
No, I see.
Every Monday night.
Yeah, the Lansing Council, there were some, I better be careful myself here, some real characters that became council people, so to speak, back in
Oh, professional, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You don't have to be careful of that for me. Because I know exactly what you're talking about. People that show up and bitch every council night. Yeah, they became well known. As a matter of fact, in the beginning, policemen never attended those.
Right.
But then now, I guess they, don't they have a policeman on to all council now?
I mean, assigned for security's sake?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure if they still do it. I know for a period of years, many years, they did have to do it because of the different ruckus situations. They would have at least one sitting in the back.
At least one, yeah. Yeah. Then there's times when they expected a big brouhaha, and they would send two or three officers up there, and they would stand so that they were, you know.
Were seen to be a deterrent.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Police presence.
Right. Yeah.
We're getting close to our hour and a half, and I think we ought to just kind of like wind this up, but I'd like to ask you if you have anything to say, kind of as a overview of your whole career at the Lansing Police Department, some of your feelings as far as when you think back on the years that you spent there.
it was a great experience. Some wonderful people. Proud time. Hope I don't get emotional about it.
It's quite all right.
But it was a proud time, and I never had a day that I hated to go to work. You know, you hear people talk about, oh, man, I got to go to work today. And they hate their boss, and they hate their job, and wish they didn't have to go to work and everything. I never had a day that I hated to go to work. As a matter of fact, there I remember times when I was a young patrolman, I'd loved the job so much that toward the end of my two-week vacation, I was ready to go back to work. I want to go back to work. I want to see the guys. I want to ride that Harley Hog. You know, it was really great. And I've always been proud of LPD. To this day, I am. And matter of fact, I had some officers here. I don't know if you know them or not, but they came in and kind of almost scared to ask me, you know, they were thinking about other departments to leave down here. One of them is Joe Brown. Do you know Joe Brown?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Billy Barnes.
Oh, yeah.
Just the other day, he come riding up on his motorcycle out here, Lynn Kentner.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He was over here. He's an accident reconstructionist now, and he'd been to Shalott to court on some case of some sort that he must have worked on. And so instead of going right straight down the highway, he swung around through town, and he just come my way here, and I happened to be out mowing the lawn. So we stood there and talked for 15, 20 minutes, and he showed me the new motorcycle, and all, but man, oh man, they got lights on them now like a Christmas tree.
But they don't have as many of them. They only got,
I think he said six.
That could be.
Yeah. I think it was six. And used mostly for ceremonial parades and
special escorts.
Funerals.
Yeah.
And things of that sort. I think LPD does a really good thing. I don't know who started all that, but these funerals, they send an officer, they have them stay there on kind of like on duty when the people are coming to view the, you know, at the funeral home or whatever. And I thought to myself, that is really a good thing to do when a policeman dies, and to have that kind of a thing. I can tell you a funny thing that happened, though, of an escort of a police death. Captain Orlo Meade was his name, and he died. And you know how the motorcycles kind of leapfrog, opening the intersections ahead?
Yes.
So I'm in this group of three or four of us, you know, opening things up. And we're coming down North Grand River, and coming up to the curve by the old sugar beet factory up there. Well, no, that's before your time now. Okay.
Not that one.
You know where it curves around like this, and that's Grand River then.
Okay.
Goes out and past the new fire station out there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going around this curve like that. Well, back then on the motorcycle, they had a little pedal like that you put your heel on and you press down like that, and it would put the siren up against the tire. And whee! You know, there's a siren going. So I'm approaching like that, and there's some traffic up there, and so I stood up on that thing and I wheeed around the curve I'm going like that. And all of a sudden, bang, bang, rattle, 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 and everything. What in the world is going on here? You know, I look back, and the apparatus had all come loose, and it was all dragging back at me.
Oh, my.
Here was this funeral back at me. And, of course, all my buddies, they rode by, and they went. It was really funny, but embarrassing, too, at the same time. Well, I heard about that for a long time.
That wasn't your fault.
No, it wasn't my fault. It was just a funny thing that happened.
Fluke thing.
Yeah,
okay.
Something to get on a guy and razz him about it, you know. We always look for that, for a little digs that we could.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We found reasons for it. make a joke out of your glasses if we wanted to.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
Well, let me thank you very much. This was an excellent interview.
Thank you.
And I want to let you know that I did change my mind and went ahead and recorded approximately three half an hours.
Oh.
And remember that they won't fit together well because there's a gap of about a minute and a half or two minutes for me to change it and for the thing to get going. But I'll send you copies of those two. But this has been very, very excellent interview. Appreciate it.
I just happened to think of another thing that was probably the most scared I was when I was working. And up on where the call box was on East Grand River before you get to Pennsylvania, the North Atlantic.
Yes.
What's that street where that call box was? It run to the north right there.
High Street?
No. Before you get to High Street. Anyway, that street there, run right up there. And a couple blocks up, there was a small house up there. And the people who lived there with his name by the last name of Scott. And Mrs. Scott was a Aunt Jemima type of a, just a nice lady, you know. And they had about, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 kids. And they were in bunks around this one bedroom like that. Now, Mr. Scott was a very good provider and a good husband on every day except sometimes Friday. It got so that they didn't even give us the address. They just said, you know, when we got a call, go to the Scott's. And I said, Mr. Scott, come home drunk again and got abusive. Well, one night, instead of saying, go to the Scots, I forget who my partner was. I think it was Al Yauch. But anyway, instead of saying, just go to the Scots, it said, meet the ambulance at the Scots. Uh-oh. Now what happened? He's killed her. That's what was going through our minds. So we hurried right up there. Well, the ambulance people were there, and kids were all there, and some of them was crying and this and that and the other thing. And here was Mr. Scott, not her, but Mr. Scott, laying down on the ground. Well, here's what happened. Sometime before that, when she said, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I don't want to leave this man. He's a good man. Well, what am I going to do? So we had said to her, you're going to have to do something. You're going to have to hit him or stick up for yourself. You're going to have to do something. Take care of things in your own hands. Well, she took us literally. Come to find out what had happened, and she told us this when we were got there. She waited for him on Friday night because he got paid in cash, and they just stop at the bar and get drunk. And he came up inside the house and he was drunk and hollering and everything, and she didn't say, yes or nothing. She grabbed a hold of the barrel of an old shotgun like this and whoom, took him right across the front like that with the stock of that thing. Knocked him cold, put him in the hospital. We were scared, my partner and I, because here the detectives show up, and it's Detective O'Toole and they were partners for a long time. O'Toole and
I know who you're saying, but I can't think of them either.
Max Seagraves.
Yes, Seagraves.
They were asking a lot of questions, and we were afraid that she was going to tell them that the cops told her to smack him, you know, because, man, he was in critical condition for a few days in the hospital, Spur Hospital. But she didn't say a word, and we didn't say a word, and we were scared for a few days, but nobody ever asked us about it, so we just kept quiet.
Well, I'm sure the statute of limitations is expired a long time.
I think that's a long.
Thank you ever so much. This has been a very enjoyable time.
Well, I enjoyed it myself.
Good.
My memory isn't as good on a lot of the things, names especially.
You did extremely well.
With time enough, I probably could talk all day.
Well, that's okay, too. We could come back and do another.